everybody.
Welcome. Planning Commission work session for September 5th. Tonight, we have a new Planning Commission member. Brian, would you like to say a few words of introduction?
Sure. Brian Halbert, Halbert Construction Services. I'm a general contractor here in Vancouver and lived in Vancouver for 28 years. I'm glad to be here and serve with you guys.
So, yeah, the first item on our list tonight is the Transportation Improvement Board. Susan?
Good evening, Commissioners. Thank you so much for the opportunity to present to you our, one of a really important document that we're in Public Works. My name is Amon Payne, Public Works Director, County Engineer. We have Susan Wilson, Gary, and also Matt Furman, both our transportation planners. And they work quite a lot of hours to put this document together. What makes this document so important is that this is a guideline and a planning document for us to make sure that not only meet the state requirement, but also our residents what's coming up in terms of projects, and it helps us to get grants, and it's outline of all the transportation improvement that we're going to be doing. So with that, we're going to walk you through that, and feel free to stop us and have any questions during that presentation. So the bulk of the load is going to be carried by Susan, so I'll let her talk more and then I'll and stop and be more happy to answer any questions you might have. Susan?
Okay, so we're getting ready to adopt the 2020-2025 Transportation Improvement Program. It's a legal document that has to be adopted in front of our county council before the budget is adopted. So I'm talking about how projects get on to the Transportation Improvement Program. A couple of the guiding principles that the council has set for us, the evaluation system. I'll be talking about some of the capital revenue and where we spend our money, and then the construction schedule and the next steps. So how does a project get on the Transportation Improvement Program? It actually starts with a comprehensive plan, and then it moves to the arterial atlas and the 20-year capital facilities plan. So Matt Herman does the capital facilities plan. He gives me a list of projects. I take those and I evaluate those. And then we prioritize them, and then we make the 6-year transportation improvement program. And then we do the annual construction program, which is the first year of the transportation improvement program. It basically tells us what we're going to spend our money on within the first year of the transportation improvement program.
And just to kind of inject on that one, so when we do our comp plan, it outlines where the area of the need for capacity improvements. And based on those and level of service that we have, not only for roadways but also concurrency, we determine what kind of improvement needs to be done and if there's if the improvement is there or if not. If not, how are we going to improve those? And based on that, we outline those projects, which lands on the 6-year transportation plan and also our capital facilities plan.
So some of the guiding principles that the council has set is we're going to pay off our debt first. And then also we're going to preserve what we have and build safety projects, and then we're going to move to the 20-year CFP projects. That's the capacity projects that Ahmad was just talking about. The TIP is a state-mandated document. It, per WAC and RCW, it has to have a priority programming. It has to be adopted in front of the council before the budget's adopted. And then also, it has to be consistent with the comprehensive plan via the capital facilities plan. That is a state mandate. So like I was saying, we take our projects from the 20-year capital facilities plan and then we evaluate them. There are 9 classifications and 4 categories: safety, economic development, mobility, and an other that can consist of economic or environmental impacts, support of the public, support of leveraging grants and other funding sources. Last year, we had updated our evaluation system to make sure it was consistent with the Highway Safety Manual, making sure all of our collision, our Injury accidents, our property damage accidents were updated. We look at 5 years, and then we look at the physical road features. Lack of shoulders, deep ditches, obstructions. So that's how we rank in the safety category. For the economic development, we look at potential industrial and commercial jobs. We look at the focused public investment areas, the freight access to highways, and then the large development ready parcels. So another thing we had done was we had met with the Columbia River Economic Development Council to make sure we weren't missing anything from the economic development criteria. And as you can see, we also look at the level of service, we look at volume to capacity, urban holding areas, we look at moratoriums, and then we compare minor arterials versus major arterials for the comparison of arterial atlas, and then mobility, route connection, and then multimodal pedestrian facilities and sidewalks, and then also trails and bus routes.
And these are really key components of the criteria because they also help us to score higher when we apply for grants. And a majority of our money for project come from state and federal grants and some of the local ones. So these are really important key criteria that we apply to selection and prioritize our project. Yeah.
And also I want to say the criteria is consistent with our funding partners. So this year, the course of 6 years, we have about a $203 million program. And this is a higher than average program. They typically range between $170 to $180 million. And the reason being is the council's decision on trying to lift the urban holding areas at 179th Street. So they had made a decision on the 20th of last month to fund these potential projects or these projects in the 179th Street area. And so that's what you're seeing here. You're seeing a large urban road project of about $115 million, 57%. That is where the urban development projects reside in the TIP. All the other projects are the ongoing programs, such as sidewalks, bridges, road preservation, and so all the urban projects are evaluated through our evaluation system. All the ongoing programs, sidewalks, bridges, preservation, they have their own evaluation. The reason being is they can't compete with these large capital projects. And so that's how we fairly rank these projects. But this is where the money's going. Preservation, about $37 million. And then bridges, about $8 million. Sidewalks, about 10%. And this is all including leveraging of dollars with grant funds. So the revenue sources, the TIP has to be financially constrained, and so we have $203 million of improvements. Well, we have $203 million of revenue coming into the TIP over the course of 6 years. As you can see, County Road Fund is the biggest revenue factor of about $70 million. We have projected grants. We don't have any loans in this program. Then we have secured grants of about $16 million, or 8%. And then we have the urban development agreements is about $7 million. And then the urban holding surcharge is about $5 million. And then we also have about $26 million of real estate excise tax, too, for the program.
I just wanted to add that road funds that we get, they're very restricted funds. They can only be applied within the rural area that... so that it is not something that we can always use at other locations.
So this is our proposed construction schedule. And the projects in gray are currently under construction or complete. I think the bulk of them are complete. 10th Avenue is, I think there's just punch list items. That's the bridge over Whipple Creek from 154th to 164th. 119th Street East, they just have punch list items, so that is open to the public. The Pacific Culvert, that was a failing culvert that we had received some County Road Administration emergency funds for, so that one is also fixed. That was an amazing, two-week construction on that?
Yeah, we had, when we had the flooding during the month of February, we had that road washed out, and luckily we were able to put everything together and get it done. Not only the repair, but also we were able to meet the requirement for fish passage, culvert type, so don't we'll have to do it again. So it'll be all done all one time. So.
We did. We preserved Highway 99 from 78th Street to 134th Street. We got about $4 million in federal funds to do that work. Klein Line Sidewalk, we added new sidewalk from 122nd to 129th. The projects in yellow are fully funded projects or grant committed projects. 99th Street over Leitner Landfill from 94th to SR 503, that is also grant funded. 99th Street at 99th Street, or Highway 99 at 99th Street intersection, we should be starting construction on that summer of 2020. Manly Road, we're going to let contracts out on that in the next couple months or so. And then we have a traffic signal optimization project, about $500,000. We're still working on executing funding contracts for that. And then we have some bridge projects that are also federally funded, and we'll be letting contracts out fall of next year. And then we have Mason Creek Culvert. We just received some funding on that project, so we're going to start design on that relatively soon. 68th Street Sidewalk, that's a partnership with the City of Vancouver from Highway 99 to St. John's. We actually received a large funding package of that, and we have $1.7 million transportation alternatives money, so we are very, very happy about that. Munch Preservation, that is a preservation project that will just be preserving the road and fixing some vertical curvature. And then the blue projects are the urban holding projects. These are to be built in 6 years, pending council approval of the traffic fee increases and the real estate excise tax during the budget adoption. So we have 10th Avenue, 15th, 179th Street, from Delphal to 15th, and then 29th and 50th. And then the pink projects are the highest priority projects that we're seeking funding on. 119th at 152nd, we submitted a grant application for some federal money. We'll hear in the next couple months if we get that. Davis Bridge replacement, we have some potential County Road Administration money to support that project. Then we also have the white projects, which are the next tier projects. Ward Road, 152nd, 119th at 132nd and 72nd. What we're doing with those is we're looking at the traffic modeling to figure out what we need to do. Do we need to blow the whole road out? Do we need to look at just the intersections? So that's what we're doing now. I'm having the traffic engineers look at that. Some of these projects take years to design, years to develop, acquire right-of-way, permitting. So all of these projects are just construction starts. They do not include what's currently under design or permitting or right-of-way acquisition.
And just to add one thing, we have about 80 bridges around the county, and they're very important key location, connecting a lot of major roads for us, for not only for emergency response, but also commercial routes for timber, other activities. And a lot of requirements from federally has changed, and especially with the type of new trucks that we're getting in terms of axle, number of axles they have. So we have to annually update them, and some of the areas we had to close for the loading requirements, and some of those larger trucks and even emergency vehicles have to be rerouted to a different direction. So that's something that we want to concentrate on, getting those bridges updated, and so that provides those key crucial access not only for commerce but also for emergency responses.
And then we have about $87 million for the ongoing programs. Again, they have their own evaluation because they cannot compete against the larger projects such as 179th, 99th Street, 119th Street. So as you can see, we spend quite a bit of money on our ongoing programs just to maintain the safety and preservation of projects. The next steps, currently we are here at the Planning Commission work session. We'll go to hearing for Planning Commission. And then we'll talk to DEEB on October 3rd, and then we'll go to council on November 7th. And then hopefully they'll be happy with the TIF, and we can adopt it for the coming year. Any questions?
I've got a question concerning the blue, the 179th projects. Mm-hmm. You got like $70 million in there. Is that 100% additional funding for those projects, a completely separate funding source?
The bulk of it is. We had about $20 million in the last six-year program. So because 179th is the next tier. It's the next tier that we have to, I mean, we'd eventually build them. But that was the next tier. So the last TIP had about $20 million. We added an additional, 50 million with real estate excise tax, the surcharge, the development agreements, and traffic impact fees.
That's
additional funding coming into our program. If we didn't have that additional funding, it'd be like $170, $180 million program.
Just to add a little bit more to that, this is one of the projects we've been working for the last 10 months. The area of Mud Vesta area has been in kind of there's not capacity for new development for a long time, and also the urban holding. So one of the direction from council was to find funding options, which last 10 months we worked, and I think a couple weeks ago the council approved one of the funding options, and that allowed us to open up funding sources for that project. And initial phase one or step one was $67 million worth of projects. And at that time, I think we had already committed about $23 million of it, and the rest of it are coming from a lot of private share contribution and grants and also REIT funding to make sure the projects can happen.
So did we have any projects fall off of the TIP?
No, we did not.
Can you go back one slide? Where is the road fund revenue come from?
They come from property taxes. The areas that are not within the urbanized or city limits, then they get assessed a portion of their property taxes, goes to road funds.
Right.
And it's based on a levy that's been assigned by the county council.
We also get gas taxes, too, about $6 million a year.
Okay, thanks.
Well, thank you. Appreciate your time.
I'm here to talk about the Complete Streets update tonight. The agenda. I'd like to call it the roadmap of where we're going to have our discussion this evening. And just a quick background, there are two key dates for the Complete Streets. So in 2011, the legislator established the Complete Streets grant program. In 2015, the legislator designated the Washington State Transportation Improvement Board as the Complete Streets granting agency that has the ability to award Complete Street grant projects flexible money anywhere from the range of $100,000 to $1 million for Complete Streets projects. And what are Complete Streets? There are transportation policies and standards that enable safe, convenient, comfortable travel and access for all users of all ages and abilities, regardless of their choice of transportation. So whether, regardless of whether they're choosing transit, driving, biking, or walking. And we've been doing complete streets for many years now here in Clark County. So up on the upper left corner of Northeast 10th Avenue, that is Whipple Creek. I believe Susan discussed that project in our six-year TIP. So we're currently in design to finish another segment from 149th to 154th. So that'll be a huge segment from 141st up to 164th. So it'll be a great asset to all of us. I've already had my friends park at the park and drive their car over there and then ride their bikes up to a show at the amphitheater. So that's just something that we'll be able to do in the future. It's very nice. And then on the right is Northeast 15th Avenue. That was built in 2007. And Northeast 37th Avenue was built in 2001. And some of the other projects that I didn't show up here is we've built Patton Parkway in 2003. That's a complete street. Northeast 119th has been built since 2014, and then we're continuing to work on building that. Northeast 25th Avenue is another one that was built in 2002. We're also going to have a Complete Streets Guideline. It's a document that describes the steps Clark County has taken, continues to take, and envisions for multimodal transportation system and the public. So it's a funding document for the Transportation Improvement Board. And then, of course, what are complete streets? What aren't they? So complete streets doesn't mean that a bike lane or sidewalk is on every street inside Clark County. It's not a silver bullet for us to say that's an instant mode choice in Clark County. It's not a silver bullet. It's not an unlimited source of money for us to create complete streets. So these are the policies that we've adopted earlier this year. We were in front of you last year to go over the adoption process. They got adopted this year. So policy 5.2.12 and 5.2.13 are the current policies. And then the Complete Streets program code, the purpose, we've got four sections that we added to this program code. So the first one is the purpose. And it encourages street and road designs that incorporate safe access to all users with the goals of promoting health, improving safety, protecting the environment, and preserving the community character. And the second piece that we've added is definitions, so complete streets and users. And the third is design. So the design, the plan scoped and design, that's basically where we're saying we're using our existing standards. We're not creating new standards for the Complete Streets program. And then we've got exceptions, the four exceptions that are specifically to the Complete Streets program. And the next steps, so we went through the County Council October of last year. I went to the Commission on Aging on August 21st, Bicycle Pedestrian Advisory Committee, and was on the 27th, and I went to DEEB this afternoon, and all of them supported the Complete Streets Development Code. There were a couple suggestions, like with the Commission on Aging, they looked at the transportation standards last year, and they had some suggestions to make sure that this development code doesn't preclude the ability of bicyclists and pedestrians to connect to a complete street. They kind of were leaning towards the fact that they would like to be able to see cul-de-sacs pass through cul-de-sacs when something's designated as a complete street, but our code doesn't preclude it, but it doesn't specifically spell it out, but it has happened in the past. We have developments where they put in a path from a cul-de-sac into a street. So it does happen. I'm just sharing what they were telling me. And then, so we've got the work session today, a planning commission on the hearing on the 19th, and a county work session with the council on the 2nd, and a county council hearing on November 5th. And that's it. I'm here to answer any questions, if you have any questions.
Could you start at the top again and just go through it?
No, I'm
just
yeah.
kidding.
So, Gary, when we have land that's inside the urban growth boundary, does it by definition then fall under this set of guidelines?
Well, so the complete streets is just a program code. So if the way this is going to, this would work, it will work. So TIB, what they're looking for are ordinances with policies, development code, and a guideline with it that explains how it works. So we would get a nominated eventually for an award, and they would come back to us, and we would say these are the projects that we would like to spend our money on inside the county. Does that answer your question?
And they only happen within the urban growth boundary, or are they
in the urban area? They're in the urban area.
Okay. We're not getting awards for product inside other city jurisdictions.
No, we wouldn't.
All right.
We wouldn't. Yeah, that wouldn't. Yes.
We're not doing it in the rural lands outside of the urban growth boundaries.
Correct.
So basically, as Gary said, this is applied to the urban area only, and the way our road standards are constructed, they support complete streets. There may be an exception here and there, but they comply with complete streets overall, and so this is just another mechanism for us to apply for grants.
We talked about this last year.
We did.
And said, hey, we're going to be developing this and bringing it back to you so we can then put in for these grants, because we do it. But we don't qualify for the grants because we don't have this program in place. Isn't that what we talked about?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Absolutely. Last year we did the comprehensive plan policies. We weren't ready to do the Title 40 code amendments to support those policies last year, and so we're here under Phase 2. Okay. Awesome.
Thank you.
Matt's next. Thanks,
Gary. Thank you, Gary.
So, good evening, planning commissioners. My name is Matt Herman with Public Works. On September 19th, I'll be presenting an arterial atlas amendment in front of you. This is otherwise known as CPZ 2019-00016. We are proposing an amendment to the arterial atlas and Title 40 Appendix F. Excuse me. Appendix F is the Highway 99 subarea plan. We would like to remove this planned road from the arterial atlas. This is a planned road. It does not exist. It is a line on the map right now. We have named it Northeast 16th Avenue, even though since the road doesn't exist, if you look up on Google Maps, you will not find a Northeast 16th Avenue in this section. But this map this line was added in approximately 2006. And then once the Highway 99 sub-area plan was recommended for approval, it was included in the Highway 99 sub-area plan as well. The proposed road or planned road runs very close to Tenney Creek. Tenney Creek is right here. It is a modeled wetland. With our amendment to the shoreline code in 2014, the buffers for wetlands were increased. So while this line on the map was in our books, it was then included inside the buffer of the wetland. So because it's inside the wetland buffer, the construction of this road would be difficult. The problem that we're trying to solve is we want to encourage redevelopment in the Highway 99 sub-area. Because of the environmental constraints, this is a costly road to construct. Therefore, it hinders redevelopment in that area.
How far out does that buffer come? Is it just the south part of the road, so the proposed road, or is it the...
Here's the modeled wetland right here that's shown in green. Steep slopes are shown in this hatch mark. So the buffer would extend. So for wetland, it has to be delineated and categorized at the time. So based on the categorization of that wetland, it could be extended all the way up to, I believe, 300 feet is the maximum. So the connection here simply would be very costly to construct. Not only is the construction hard here, but also the planned road goes through mobile home park, and that is very difficult to redevelop as well.
Well, most likely that mobile home park will be sold to somebody who will redevelop it and put it in their own streets.
Correct.
Maybe not.
So the pros of removing this road is it does allow less costly redevelopment of the land. The consideration is the local road would be relied on Highway 99. The planned road is to accommodate local trips off of Highway 99. Without the road, those local trips would be on Highway 99 as they exist today. So a road like this can accommodate up to 3,000 average daily trips per day. The development of the area would potentially have 3,000 trips per day. So those, if full development happens on the site, those 3,000 trips would go on to Highway 99. Highway 99 does have multimodal aspect. It has bike lanes, sidewalks, and transit. This local road would have sidewalks at the most.
So the purpose of this originally was just to make traffic flow better on Highway 99.
Correct.
But we think that removing this isn't going to blow Highway 99, make it not meet concurrency.
You're correct. Yeah, we think the redevelopment of the property is more important.
Have we talked to the property owners about taking this off? I would assume they're favorable to it.
So we talked to property owners. They received our mailers in the mail. The site has been posted. We have talked to Team Highway 99, which is the advisory committee for the Highway 99 sub-area plan. They were favorable for this being removed from the arterial atlas, and we're moving forward with that.
Was those 3,000 trips based on the property as it is now or after the 300-foot potential buffer?
Based on my analysis of the comprehensive plan designation as commercial and the potential trips that could come from that comprehensive plan.
You would certainly have a lot less land to develop if you had a 300-foot buffer. from Tenney Creek.
That's just from the wetland area, not from the entire area.
So, it would reduce those trips, is what I would think.
So all the affected land from 112 down to 106th is all commercial?
Correct.
On that, the west side of 99?
Correct.
Including the mobile home park?
Not only the four.
Mobile home park is multifamily. Excuse me. So here's how it exists in the Highway 99 sub area plan. This is an activity center in the Highway 99 sub area plan, which means it is a node of redevelopment emphasis. It is intended to be basically a community emphasis of commercial and commercial activity. So it would be removed from the Highway 99 plan as well. This is scheduled for the hearing on September 19th, and then on to the County Council based on your recommendation.
And on the east side, 104th is still designated as an arterial.
104th here?
Yeah.
Believe that is a collector?
Matt's got it. He knows what he's doing. He's all over this. He does this every day, 3-4 times a day.
The shortcuts on our computer are different. Okay, when we come in here.
He's a collector, two lanes with a bunch of.
And why do you ask that question? I'm just curious. What's your thought process behind that question?
On the map.
Other potential ways traffic can go.
Is that what you're thinking?
I mean, they're not going to go with
this. This road right here coming all the way through, right?
Oh, that could be.
I can get you an answer by the hearing time.
Well, I was looking on the pictures, and it looks cross-hatched, which appears to be by the key proposed arterial. And on the west side, where 106th comes in, and then it goes south down as an arterial on 13th. And I'm just looking at the volume of the commercial space that's there and saying it's got a large potential, and it's all going to be a matter of how it redevelops, on whether there's an impact there. Is it going to be right turn only? Yeah, there it is.
So it does exist, obviously. It's not planned road. Neighborhood circulator. So a little greater width than a local road, smaller than a collector.
Okay.
You said smaller than a collector, right?
Yeah.
Are you concerned that the amount of trips is going to...
I'm concerned just in the context of for the amount of acreage of commercial property available, how it develops within the entrance and exits. Is it going to be just like a whole series of private driveways going in and out? Or are we going...
Our circulation requirements require them to connect to the lesser classified road. If the lesser classified road, which in this case would be the 106, if that were not feasible due to the environmental constraints, we would require them to connect at 107th, where intersection currently exists, signalized intersection currently exists.
So realistically, there could still be two intersections on that.
Okay. And very well possibly, because they're two different owners, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, you have the trailer, the mobile home park, which is...
And the car lot.
And then you got the car lot, yeah. So very well could go two separate times.
And as much as possible, we try to consolidate driveways and require just one driveway if it's down the property line.
And I'm just going to ask this because why don't we just leave it there? Why don't we just leave it? It's just a line on the map.
So right now it's a straight-up requirement. If a property were to come in and they want to redevelop, it's required. They have to.
They have to build it because that line's on that map.
Yep.
Construct, we can't say, dedicate. No, let's move it. Let's do it.
There's a little bit of flexibility, but they have to provide it. By removing it, there are circulation requirements that would be required. That the redevelopment would have to meet, but it wouldn't be as specific as this line right here.
Okay.
Good question.
You can ask questions.
I'm going to ask another question. Has anybody come forward and said, "Yeah, I'm really looking at this, but that street's on there, so I don't want to touch it"? Have we had that conversation with the developer or something? It's happened. It's just we can't do it all. So, okay.
I can tell you, representing property owners in this exact situation, even without the wetland, they'd be talking about how do we get rid of that street because we can't develop with that street, and we'll have to sue the county if you won't get rid of the street because it's taking our property. It's not proportional to make us build that street, that kind of stuff.
Okay.
You add a huge wetland in the middle of the street that has to be built, and all those arguments get magnified.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I can understand why. Think about getting rid of it. And they do have these block standards you got to meet and jump through a bunch of other hoops. So it's not like it's going to be a free for all just because the street's not on the map. Okay.
We don't like to use the term jump through hoops, but.
I thought I read that somewhere in here.
No, I was just teasing. I said, we don't like to use the term jump through hoops.
I thought the word bag was in there too.
But the mobile home park, I mean, I've represented people redeveloping those. That's really challenging, and it's heartbreaking because you have, you know, all those people come in and say, "Well, all my life savings in this, you know, in this mobile home, and I can't move it anywhere because it doesn't meet current standards."
Yeah.
And so you're basically telling me I got to pay to haul it off to a junkyard somewhere, and that's hugely expensive. And basically, you know, you're taking my life savings.
Typically, they're on.
You get like 100 people coming in and with the same story on that. When you go read that, those are really hard to redevelop, and the laws have changed to make it harder for the property owner as well.
That's what I'm saying. Hmm. Yeah, can just walk away from it. Yeah.
Okay.
If they're starting in an orchard, it's one of the letters.
I've got all my questions answered.
Okay, thank you too.
see you on the 19th.
Historic preservation code.
Hello. Good evening. My name is Jackie Camp. I'm with Clark County Community Planning, and I'm one of the staff person for the Historic Preservation Program and the Commission. At the staff report, which is a memo from the Historic Preservation Commission that you'll see in your hearing packet and in the work session today, it was prepared by Sharon. So Sharon and I both assist the Historic Preservation Commission, but I'll be doing the presentation this evening. So tonight we're going to be talking about some minor amendments to the Historic Preservation Code. And I'll give some reasons why we are doing so. The county has interlocal agreements with the seven cities and town of Yackel regarding the Historic Preservation Program. The last agreements, those interlocal agreements, were updated in 1997. And reference an old ordinance that points to the what was our previous code. So in 2018, if those of you that were on the commission last year, we did a pretty large update to the Historic Preservation Code to clarify some processes that were a little complex and unclear to kind of help staff and the applicants move through the historic preservation processes. So now that we did that update, there was a new ordinance with part of that code update. So the interlocal agreements need to be updated to point to and reference the updated ordinance. So the county and the city of Vancouver are both what we call certified local governments, which is a designation by the state Washington Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, which means that either could have a historic preservation program, could have a historic commission, and abide by all the rules and regulations that come with that designation. But since the beginning of our programs, we've always had a joint historic preservation commission. So we work together, and then we have interlocal agreements with all these smaller cities. So the county provides services and application review for all the property owners that are in the smaller cities. So when we began talking about updating the interlocal government agreements for this round, the city of Vancouver inquired whether or not we could consider a change in how we appoint historic preservation commission members. So to kind of match how other city county commissions are appointed. So this one has been a little bit different, and they would like to make it similar to the other ones, which would also help with our current appointment process, which is pretty complex and convoluted. So that's kind of part, that's part of what this update is about. And another one has to relate to the appeals process for properties that are in the smaller city jurisdictions, making sure that the code is clear of talking about where appeals go to, because the cities can choose how that process goes. So just to kind of share with you how our current appointment process is, to kind of why this conversation began. So the Historic Preservation Commission gets involved in the appointment process. Since it's a specific criteria that's part of code that who should be on the commission, they like to make sure they've got the wide range of backgrounds that have been helpful for reviewing these historic preservation cases. So they have a committee that reviews the applications. They do an interview where they bring a case study and they have the applicant kind of go through a previous case that they reviewed and how they would make their criteria and review those cases. Then they select their candidates that they would like to recommend. And then the next step, it would go to City Council, those recommendations. The City Council would then have the opportunity to interview applicants themselves, so they could interview the ones the commission interviewed, or they could interview some new ones, all in the applicant pool, but it might be different applicants. And then the city would select who they would recommend, and they would recommend give a formal recommendation to County Council, who then would have the commission's recommendations, the Vancouver City Council's recommendations, and could have their own interview process and select whom they would like to appoint. So for an applicant, this can be very, they can be interviewed three times, which had happened one year. So that's kind of one of the reasons we'd like to streamline this. So currently the Commission's code, or the Historic Preservation Code, says that there's a minimum of 5 members. We currently have 7, and that seems to work well for them. If there's, as I mentioned, kind of specific criteria of background or experience or interest that applicants or that the commission and the county are looking for in the city for people that would like to be on the Historic Commission. And then we always have to have at least 2 professionals who have experience or background in the list of those fields. So we are required by our code to do that. So the amendments that are proposed, and you'll see in your packet, has to do with increasing the number of HP members from 5 to 7. So we're going to have 7 from now on. And for the City of Vancouver to appoint 2 of those members through their process, and then the county council would appoint the 5. So that's how we would split those appointment processes. The third part of this is, as I mentioned, updating the appeals process on Historic Commission decisions. So it would say that properties that are in the cities and town, it would be indicated in their code what the appeals process would be, and if they chose not to put something in code because they may just point to the county code, which many do, then it would just default to our county appeals process, which is to Superior Court. So that's kind of the amendment for the appeals process there. So in your packet, you'll see the whole Historic Preservation Code, and you'll see the yellow highlights of where these changes are. So the commission appointments kind of at the beginning, and then the appeals is kind of later on in the code. So if we went ahead and did this, just wanted to show kind of the condensed version now of the appointment process for members. So the HPC would review and then do their interviews and recommend to, depending on which seat it was. So if it was a county seat, they would be given that recommendation to county. If it was one of the city seats, they'd give it to the city. And then it would move along their processes for official appointment. So that's where we are. So we've already, yes.
I'm sorry.
Sir.
Can you back up to
yeah.
that? So basically the smaller cities don't have, they're not part of this?
Right. So the City of Vancouver and Clark County are certified local governments. So technically we could have 2 separate historic commissions.
Okay.
The smaller cities are not certified local governments. So we assist them through the interlocal agreements with properties in their jurisdictions. So
the previous, that you guys, basically the county said, hey, we're going to let you interview as well, the smaller cities, and be a part of the process?
No, the smaller cities do not.
No.
The Historic Commission interviews and then was recommending to City Council of Vancouver.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood
yeah.
how that
because, yeah,
process.
So we had that partnership because it was a joint commission.
Yeah, I thought that was odd. Sorry, I misread
oh,
that.
Oh, no worries. No worries.
Okay.
So we've briefed the council on this at work session earlier this summer. The Historic Preservation Commission has reviewed it, and they held a hearing, and that's the recommendation that you'll see in your packet here today on September 5th for your work session, and then the hearing on the 19th, and then we go to council in October for both work session and hearing. That is the amendments.
So the Historic Preservation Commission is okay with City Council or City Hearings Examiner or whoever the cities have second-guessing their decisions in an appeal process? Because that, to me, that's the biggest change here. Is
the appeals process.
Yeah, instead of having the final local decision being the Historic Preservation Commission, you know, and then you're arguing in court, you know, we're going to now have some other entity at a city.
It's
going to make the final decision, and then they're going to be able to make decisions. I assume they can hold evidentiary hearings if their code allows, and so then factual determinations might be decided differently by whatever that appellate body is. And the Historic Preservation Committee has considered that, and they're okay with that.
Yes, they're aware of that. I mean, our current interlocal agreements have the cities already deciding that I think it goes before City Council. So they need to look at that, decide what their process is. But our recommendation is going to say, can we make this as similar as, so everyone's kind of going through the same process, and we're going to recommend Superior Court would be the easiest, but it's going to be totally up to them as to decide their process.
Okay. Well, and there's a different, you know, if it's Superior Court, then any factual determination, there should be a lot of deference to the final decision maker versus if it's a city council, they're going to be the ones that get the deference because they're going to be the final local decision maker.
How did we end up with a 2-5 split?
That's what the city recommended to county, the council, and they were okay with moving forward with that as the proposal. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. See you in a couple weeks.
All right.
We have one more.
We have one more?
One more.
Not on our list on their website.
Shoreline.
Is it? Oh, there it is. Yeah. It's hiding.
Where? All right. No. I don't know where you see it. Shoreline? Oh, I saw that earlier.
Yeah, I was ready to skip off the floor.
That was
referee. I'm not sure anymore, so I can't adjourn the meeting.
So I'm Jenna Kay, also with Community Planning, and I am going to provide a brief update on our Shoreline Master Program Periodic Review, which is a project that we're just getting started. So this is the first time I'm here to talk to you about it, but I'll be back later as the project progresses. So I'm just going to do a quick refresher on the Shoreline Management Act, talk about what this project is, look at the timeline of it, and then can answer any questions. So the Shoreline Management Act was passed by the legislature in 1971, and its intent is to prevent the inherent harm in an uncoordinated and piecemeal development of the state shorelines. And in the act, you know, it sets out the goals and policies for what it's trying to do, as well as sets up the framework on how you do development along shorelines. And we implement the Shoreline Management Act through our local Shoreline Master Programs. And so we develop and adopt them locally, and they are also approved and adopted by the State Department of Ecology. The three main policy goals in the Act are to foster reasonable and appropriate uses, to protect natural resources, and to promote public access. And if you look at what our Shoreline Master Program is actually made up of, our policies and goals live in the comprehensive plan. Our regulations on what uses and activities you can do along shoreline live in our code. And then we have a map that shows where the program applies. And in Clark County, we have over 300 miles of shoreline that fall under the Shoreline Management Act. There are two rivers which are of statewide significance, so that's the Columbia and the Lewis Rivers. And then the other shorelines that fall under the Act are all stream segments with a mean annual flow of 20 cubic feet per second. So that's everything from Salmon Creek, Burnt Bridge Creek, Washougal River, you know, the major streams within the county. It also impacts lakes greater than 20 acres. So that would be Lake Vancouver, Lake Merwin, and Yale Lake as well. And so then if we zoom in and look at like what exactly is a shoreline, it applies to water bodies and their associated shorelands. And those shorelands are defined as lands that extend 200 feet in all directions on a horizontal plane from the ordinary high water mark. It includes floodways and contiguous floodplain areas landward 200 feet from such floodways. It includes the full extent of floodplains, and it includes all wetlands and river deltas associated with the streams and lakes in the program. So this is what we're talking about when we talk about shorelines.
What does the OHWM stand for?
That is ordinary high water mark. So think bathtub ring, gotcha. You know, of your water body. So the Shoreline Management Act was around for a couple of decades before the Growth Management Act existed, but the two laws are interconnected in a few ways. So shoreline management is now the 14th goal of GMA. And one of the ways they intersect is that for our critical areas, so our wetlands, habitat, flood hazard areas, critical aquifer recharge areas, all of those critical areas, if they exist within shoreline jurisdiction, our shoreline master program is what regulates them. If they fall outside of shoreline jurisdiction, our critical areas ordinances are what regulates them. So we have this sort of parallel regulation structure going on. And the law also says that we need to make sure our shoreline regulations protect our critical areas at least as well in the shoreline as we protect, as they need to be protected just as well in shoreline as they are protected outside of shoreline. Our code is set up so that our shoreline code just points to our critical areas code, so they're the same regulations, but we have to sort of keep them both updated to keep them the same. Okay, so that's enough background for now. So the county did a comprehensive update of its Shoreline Master Program that they finished in 2012. And since then, we've done a couple of amendments to Shoreline Code since that time. And now we are required to do a periodic review. And the Shoreline Management Act says that we need to review our Shoreline Master Program every 8 years and revise it if necessary. So this is not a comprehensive update like we did in 2012. This is more of a, let's make sure you're not missing anything and you're current and you're making sure the plan is up to date. So we need to make sure it's current with changes in laws and rules, it's consistent with other Clark County plans and regulations, and that it's responsive to changed circumstances, new information, and improved data. Earlier this week, the County Council adopted our public participation plan for this project, which outlines our work program and schedule and the components of public participation that will be involved. We're planning to do sort of two rounds of outreach. So the first round really is largely informational, making sure people know this project is happening, and if there are things they want us to keep in mind as we go through the project, that would be the time for them to share it with us early on. And then once we have drafts of things that we're proposing to change, we would go out again to get more specific feedback on those. So we'll do some open houses. In addition to visiting with you periodically, we'll also be keeping the Development and Engineering Advisory Board engaged, the Clean Water Commission, and the Parks Advisory Board as well. And we'll be talking to any neighborhood association or other interest group who wants to talk to us about shorelines. When we get into the more formal adoption process, we have to do a 30-day comment period. So that will happen before the Planning Commission's hearing when we get to that point later on in the process. And it'll be a joint comment period with the Department of Ecology. And then we'll move into the Planning Commission and Council hearings. So visually, we are now in box two, in the middle here. So we've kicked it off, and we are just starting our outreach to let people know this project is happening. And so we'll be doing that, doing more outreach and developing a proposal throughout the rest of the year. And then next year we'll kick into the formal process of having a final draft that goes out for comment. We do SEPA, and then we would come back to you to do get ready for your hearing on the topic. The Department of Ecology, because they do also have to approve this, they are, after whatever you all recommend at your hearing, it will get sent to the Department of Ecology, and they're going to provide us with an initial determination of what they think. And then your recommendation and Ecology's initial determination will go to the County Council before they make their decision, and then it will go back to Ecology for a final determination.
Why wouldn't we see it after Ecology gives you the initial determination?
Why wouldn't... Oh, well, so this is a new optional process. So previously, ecology wouldn't be formally involved until after county council. So county council would make their decision, and then ecology holds their own comment period, and then they would weigh in. This is our other option, basically. So I'll be talking to ecology throughout the process, so we will informally know what they think before it comes to you. But in terms of the process they've laid out, that is where their initial determination falls between Planning Commission and Council. Oh, it's due June 30th, 2020.
Not that rushed.
Yes,
so, any other questions? So, once we have some sort of draft proposals, I'll come back.
We'll be back.
Yeah. All right. Thank you very much.
Okay.
And I have one more.
You are going to put one that's not on the...
We are, but it's actually for Chris, so we're going to...
All
right. Happy thoughts.
Happy thoughts.
Happy thoughts.
As long as we don't talk about the railroad.
I had no intention of mentioning that word. On August 20th, the Court of Appeals issued its decision in our GMA appeal. And you may recall that there are three major issues that Clark County had appealed. And one of those concerned the establishment of the Rural Industrial Land Bank. The Growth Board held that the county had not properly de-designated the agricultural land and not properly made it industrial. So that's one. And then the other two were related to the Ridgefield and La Center urban growth boundary expansions. And again, the Growth Board held that the county hadn't properly de-designated that land and made it urban, and also held that the urban growth boundaries of Ridgefield and La Center were large enough that they didn't need to be expanded at that time. So the complication with the urban growth boundaries was that as soon as they were expanded and that land was de-designated, those cities annexed the land so that it was part of the incorporated cities. Land that's in incorporated cities is planned by the cities. It's not planned by the counties. And the county had no control over the annexation. So as soon as the land was annexed, it became part of the cities, under the city's jurisdiction, and not susceptible to any land use actions by the county, even if the Growth Board really wanted the county to do those things, which it did. So the county has been, those expansions were called non-compliant with GMA and invalid in March of 2017 when the Growth Board issued its first decision, and then three times since then on compliance orders. The county is supposed to take the Growth Board's decision about what in their comprehensive plan complies with GMA and what doesn't, and to make the stuff that doesn't comply, comply. And you, those of you who are here should recall that you have seen some of those issues, you know, changing Ag 10 back to Ag 20 and changing the rural zones back to being three different rural designations, things like that. So we've done those things. We also eliminated, deleted, whatever. We rescinded the expansion of the battleground urban growth boundary, which was also held to be non-compliant because They hadn't annexed that land, so it was still within the county's control to do so. So all four of those orders, the final decision and order and the three compliance orders, the county, the cities, and the property owners ordered that the growth board, or argued that the growth board could not tell the county to somehow change the planning status of the expansion areas because they're in cities, and the growth board, stood firm saying Clark County failed to comply with GMA and must take steps to comply. Not that the growth board ever told the county exactly what it thought the county should do. In any event, that was a subject of appeal to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals agreed with us on that, ruled that the annexed lands, their planning status was moot, and that the growth board had no authority to tell the county what to do with those lands because the county can't do anything with those lands. So that was the good news. The bad news is there were two appeals. They were consolidated. There was an appeal of the final decision and order and an appeal of the first compliance order, and they were consolidated at the Court of Appeals and briefed and argued together. Unfortunately, the county did not serve its appeal of the final decision and order correctly, so that petition was dismissed. However, we served the appeal of the compliance order just fine. Same issues, same parties, same arguments. So they heard those. The court did rule against the county with respect to the Rural Industrial Land Bank. So ruled that we should not have de-designated that land. So that's what's up. Typically, future-wise, we'll seek reconsideration of an unfavorable decision at the Court of Appeals, and a motion for reconsideration will be due this Monday. They haven't filed it yet. Maybe they won't. Don't know. But we'll see. So that's what's up, and I expect that something will be coming to you in the future to respond to further to the comprehensive plan situation. So that's it. Okay. Questions?
Adjourned.